No, it wasn't a ball game. Anyway, there was going to be a benefit ball game up in New York. They're going to play at the Polo Grounds, and it was a mixed team of the Yankees, the Dodgers, and the Giants. They were going to play an all-star Army team. And me just going in the Army, naturally McPhail thought of me right away.
You were fresh. I mean, you hadn't gotten hospital.
That's right. So they got the colonel down there at Fort Meade to ship me up to New York to play in that game. And the thing I remember about it was the fact that I think they sold $800 million in war bonds for that game. And I got my wife a seat for $10,000. That was given to me. I didn't have that much money.
$800 million?
They made $800 million in the sale of war bonds in that ball game. They were selling those box seats in the Polo Grounds. I don't know whether you have been there or not, but they had a sort of a horseshoe effect from first base to home, and they were selling $1 million a box. So you can imagine what kind of a day they had. And they had, oh, I would say, a 5 or 6 hour show by all the leading celebrities in Hollywood. And in those days, that show Yankee Doodle Dandy came out with Jimmy Cagney, and he had the whole personnel of the cast. They were all there, and they put on a whole show, and we sure enjoyed it.
Great. Okay. Did you play ball regularly while you were in the Army?
No, I didn't. I remember one year I was traveling through Denver. I was going to be a machine gunner on an airplane. What do you call it? Armored gunner I was going to be.
Okay.
And the major down there was going through the personnel records, and he saw where I had played ball. So they got me out of that class and let me play ball that whole summer in Denver, Colorado. They had a league out there called the Victory League. I guess we played about 50 games. And then at the end of the Victory League, we run into trouble over in Europe in that Ruhr pocket. And I got shipped to the infantry then, and I went overseas, and I didn't play any more ball until I reported to Phillies in spring training in 46. So I missed about, I went about a year and a half or 2 years without even picking up a baseball.
I see. So you did get overseas. You were shipped out to Europe directly from Fort Meade?
I went down to Texas for my spring, my infantry training, and then I went from Texas to overseas.
I see.
And then after we got through over there, we were one of a few outfits that got sent over to Japan. So I saw quite a bit of action in Europe, but over in Japan we were an occupational force.
I see. And you were discharged in time to begin the 46 season?
Yes.
I see.
Yeah, I do have a little amusing story about it. I met up with a first sergeant over in Japan, and he was from my hometown. We were born and raised together. So as time went on, I knew that I was going to have to make the next shipment home in order to have any chance of making spring training. So we got together, and we decided that I needed 5 more points. So I went back to my old outfit, and I couldn't find anybody, so I just wrote a little note to myself saying that Sergeant Murtaugh was entitled to 5 more points, and I picked some battle out in Central Europe. And I come back, and I remember the CO couldn't authorize it, he said, because it wasn't signed. And so by hook or by crook, we got the CO to sign it, and as soon as he signed it, I had access to the next boat coming home. So I sort of cheated 5 points a little bit to get home in order to get to spring training. But oddly enough, when I did report to spring training in 1946, I had forgotten all about how to play baseball. I still recall that every time I did bat in spring training, that was with the Phillies, that I thought every ball that the other pitcher threw was going to hit me right in the head. And I knew there wasn't any way that I could play good enough to stay in the major leagues. And I would say right about after a week of the season, they sent me to Rochester. And I had the same trouble for about 2 or 3 weeks. And then one day I walked out on that field, and it seemed like about 30 pounds just dropped off me all at once. And I could run and field, and I could see the ball from the pitcher, and then I was on my way back again. It was an unusual circumstance, and I don't know how to describe it, but just in one day it happened, just overnight, it all came back to me.
I see. I'd like to ask you about some players. Before I get into that, what do you remember about William Cox, the owner in 43? I guess he was barred from baseball.
Well,
changing the name of the Phillies to the Blue Jays.
I didn't even remember what name we did use in those days, but the one thing I do remember about Bill Cox, he had made me a promise when I was signing a contract that winter. It was a verbal agreement, and I had been in baseball a few years then, and I'd always thought that any time an owner made a promise, it was a law. In other words, they didn't have to write anything down for me. But then when I did get shipped to the Army, I asked him if I didn't expect all the money that he promised me, but since I'd played up until August, I thought I did have a share of the money he promised coming to me. And he told me that he didn't make that promise. And I remember my wife was listening to me when I spoke on the phone to the gentleman, and I would say that in my conversation with him, I used some baseball language plus Army language that I had picked up along the line. And that's the first time I've ever, and last time, I had ever spoken disrespectful to an owner of a Major League Ball Club. I thought that Bill Cox lied to me, and I had no respect for him whatsoever.
I see. I guess that was some season. Harris got fired in mid-season. I understand you were about to strike, and Benny Culp said there was a meeting at 2 a.m.
Yeah, I was up in St. Louis.
Merrill May chewed Cox out, I guess.
I forget most of the details, but I do know that Bucky Harris was fired the night before they were going to have a war bond game or something up in St. Louis. And when we got wind of it, we didn't like the way in which it was handled. In other words, instead of Mr. Cox calling Bucky himself or having a meeting with Bucky, he sent an emissary over to tell Bucky that he was replaced.
I understand it hit the press first. Now, Cox told the press first?
Possibly it had. The details are a little bit hazy. So we had a meeting in one of the rooms. I forget which one it was now. And I recall at that time I said, I'll go along with anything, what anybody else does, because I'm going in the Army next week, and what we do won't have any effect upon me whatsoever. So we did stay in the room. It was about an 8 o'clock game, and we stayed in the room talking until we finally got an apology from Mr. Cox, and then we went to the ballpark, and I guess we got there about 45 minutes late, and then we played the game.
And you say it was a war bond game. So was this against the Cardinals?
Against the Cardinals.
A service team.
It was sort of one of those, I guess, war bond games, you
would
call
it. One of the promotional games.
Promotional, to get money for the defense services.
Sure, I see. I'd like to ask you some questions about some people associated with Phillies baseball at that time. But what kind of a fellow was Hans Lobert? He managed the club before.
Hans Lobert, I was crazy about Hans Lobert. I thought, in those days, Hannes was over 60 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall that I was with Hannes about...
Hershey in 1943, and he said the field was pretty poor. Do you remember anything about that?
Well, I do remember a little bit about the field. About that time, we thought all the fields were pretty good because it was going to be training in the north. You know, being in Hershey, Pennsylvania, naturally they had a lot of snow that winter, and they didn't have time to operate on the field and get it in the big league playing condition. But I thought it was short, as far as my recollection, as right now, and I thought it was surrounded by some hedges, because we used to have to run around the hedges every day. That's a thing that seems to stick in my mind. But I thought for overall training in the north, it was good facilities. I was impressed. We ate I guess it wasn't a YMCA, but I think they had some kind of a huge central building up there. And that's where we ate, and I thought we slept there at the same time.
Mm-hmm. But what about the field itself? Was it full of stones? I mean, strictly a cow pasture?
I would imagine if you played on the same field now, it would be filled with stones. But I do think that it wasn't a good field, but they had done more work that winter on the field than I possibly would have guessed at any time the field was there. So it wasn't a very good playable field. It was just a field, I would have to say.
Do you have any other interesting stories about spring training up north?
Well, the most amazing thing to me, I do know we spend a lot of money to get out of spring training in the South, but I don't recall any pitcher that year on the Phillies coming up with a sore arm as a result of the training in the North. So I would imagine that a lot of these people that think that spring training is expensive and overly long might be going back to the war years when they did train in the North and they didn't have all the facilities to train under, and there was very few injuries or sore arms.
I see. Any humorous stories? I know that you, I guess, had training tables that you ate in the cafeteria, and if you didn't make meals on time, you went without.
Well, actually, when you're getting back to the war years, every time we did take a trip, naturally we had to do it on a train because they had that extraction of gas or something, and they wouldn't permit us to use the buses. The men in civilian clothes always felt like outcasts. At that time, practically everybody at our age was in uniform, and we sort of had to sneak on and off the train. But we all know it was only temporary because we were all going to be in it sooner or later.
So there were a lot of servicemen traveling with you on the trains in 42 and 43.
Yes, and in those days, they very rarely held the cars open for us. In the past, when you travel with a major league ball club, they usually had a car open for you, and you'd go in and take over the car. But even as late as 43, it was still on a first-come, first-served basis. Now, I do know a couple trips we did take that we didn't have any eating facilities. In other words, normally we had our own eating facilities on the ball club. We had access to the dining room, or I don't know what they call it on the train now. It's been so long since I've eaten. Dining car. And there was a few trips that we did go a little bit hungry until we reached our destination.
I see. Were you ever bumped off one of these regular trains and forced to take a troop train?
No, not that I recall.
Benny Culp, I guess, had one interesting story about taking the troop train from Boston in April when it was cold and there was a pot-bellied stove in the middle of one of the cars, and I guess you just gathered around and played cards and chatted.
Well, I would say that there was a lot of car playing then because we weren't free to walk up and down like we normally did. And I would imagine that was one of the few times where there were mixed poker games. In other words, I would say normally when a baseball club travels with itself, all the car games are with members of the ball clubs themselves. But in those days, we did have a few Army, Navy, and Marine personnel sitting in our car games.
Oh, fine. Do you have any other interesting stories, say, about food rationing or travel restrictions?
Well, no. You know, it's pretty hard. I haven't even thought about those days for the last 30 years. And it's rather difficult picking them right up. Mm-hmm. But I would say that most of the lines, both travel lines, well, we traveled by train in all those days, they went out of the way to help the Major League ball clubs because we all felt that we were doing quite a job, too, maintaining the morale at home. And therefore, we thought that we were a necessity, and I believe Congress thought the same because they didn't discontinue baseball. So therefore, even though we weren't in the service at that particular time, we felt that we were raising the morale of the country because of the fact that so many boys did want to see baseball players. I know we had a lot of baseball games when we went to these Army camps to play. Mm-hmm. And I would say that, well, personally myself, a few times when I went over to Fort Dix to play, I met a lot of boys from my hometown and I was sort of a message bearer. In other words, they'd all see me out there playing and they would all come over and give me messages to tell the folks back home, because that was a POE in those days. They were getting ready to ship out overseas and probably they weren't allowed to call home, and they would write notes and all, and I'd deliver for them.
I see. A couple of American leaguers, specifically Bobby Doerr and Lum Harris, have said that they noticed the definite difference in the ball during the war than before and after. Of course, they were American leaguers. What about the National League? Did you notice any difference in the ball, say, in 42 and 43, and then after the war, or between 41 and 42?
Well, I would say about 42, the ball definitely became less alive. In other words, I don't know what it was a result of, whether they couldn't get the string or they couldn't get that little cork center, or else because of everybody going into defense work that they couldn't get the personnel to properly wind the balls. But I would say in 1942 and 43, the balls didn't travel quite as far as they did before the war started. And I thought it was because they didn't have enough skilled workers in those days. I think they come out with a ball, a ballat or something.
A ballat ball, yeah.
A ballat ball.
I read about that recently in Sports Illustrated.
And I saw some big men in my day crank up and hit that ball as hard as they could. It wouldn't come anywhere near the fence. It was a boon to us fellas that didn't hit the ball hard. In other words, we could get back to bunting and just hit the ball over the infield. But those big guys, I guess they had the ball into effect about a month or 2 months. I don't know how long it was in there.
Is that all?
That's all.
And they did away with it.
Then they did away with it. But we were back in our own element there, where us guys that could run a little bit, we had a lot of fun for a while.
I see. I believe you went into service when, after the 43 season?
During the 43 season.
Oh, during the 43 season. Do you want to tell me the circumstances under which you went in and what service?
Well, I was drafted, and I think it was about July, and I was reported down at Fort Meade. And
you were Army?
I was in the Army, and after you were drafted, naturally you didn't have your choice of services. And I'll never forget the first day I reported to Fort Meade. Some colonel come down looking for a guy named Murtaugh, and I said, my gracious, I've only been here an hour. I haven't done anything wrong yet that I know of. And Larry McPhail then was working Secretary of the Army or something, working in that field, and they were having a big baseball game up in the polo grounds. They had a mixed team.